Thank you very much for the kind introduction. Thank you all for coming out today to hear me speak. What I want to do is talk about why there has been a significant deterioration in U.S.-Russian relations over the past year. I want to talk about what I think is the principal cause of this problem and also talk about the dangers associated with it. And the way I would like to proceed is I would like to first just talk about the general situation today, then talk about what the conventional wisdom is in the United States and in the West more generally about what has caused this deterioration in relations. Then number three, I'd like to give you my view on what I think are the real causes, because I think, as will become clear, that the conventional wisdom, what most people in America believe, is fundamentally wrong. And then finally, I'd like to tell you what I think is the solution to the problem, which I think is quite straightforward and commonsensical. And it actually shocks me that we sort of haven't moved in that direction so far. Basically, what's happened here is that since February 22nd of this year, of last year, of 2014, relations between the Russians and the Americans, which were not terribly good, but were okay beforehand, have gone down the toilet bowl. And as you know, in early March, the Russians took Crimea, the Crimean Peninsula, from Ukraine, and they have been heavily involved in a conflict in eastern Ukraine that is actually very dangerous. What's going on in eastern Ukraine today is a war by virtually all accounts, and it's a war that involves the Russians. And because the Americans are on the other side of the conflict and the West Europeans are on the other side of the conflict, in a very important way, this is the West against the Russians. We're not actually fighting with the Russians in Ukraine, but we've been talking about or hinting that we might aid the Ukrainians. This is actually a very dangerous situation because the Russians have made it clear that they consider Ukraine to be a core strategic interest. And in effect, that means that what we're doing is presenting the Russians with an existential threat. And that is not a good thing because this is a country that has thousands of nuclear weapons. And as you know, when great powers get scared, they often do wild and crazy things, as the United States has demonstrated since September 11th. This is a very dangerous situation, and there's no evidence that things are getting better. In fact, it appears that things are as bad as ever regarding the crisis over Ukraine. This has huge consequences for the United States, in large part because we need the Russians to help us deal with Iran. We need the Russians to help us deal with Syria. Remember who pulled Barack Obama's chestnuts out of the fire in the late summer of 2013 when the Syrians used chemical weapons? It was the Russians. We need the Russians to help us get out of Afghanistan. We need the Russians to maintain a number of important arms control treaties that are now threatened. We need the Russians to help us tie down loose nukes. And we're going to need the Russians to help us deal with China. And in fact, driving the Russians into the arms from a geopolitical point of view is completely crazy. So this is a very, very dangerous and bad situation for the United States. So the question is, how did we get into this mess? Now, the conventional wisdom in the United States is that it's Putin's fault. And this is in large part because the United States never blames itself or its allies for any of the world's problems. It's always the other guy. Listening to Americans talk about foreign policy is like listening to my kids talk about who's responsible for their misdeeds. It's never their fault. It's always someone else's fault. This is how Americans talk about foreign policy. We never do anything wrong. Our ability to look in the mirror and see a true picture of ourselves is just non-existent. It's really quite remarkable. And, of course, in this situation, what we've decided to do is we've decided to blame Putin. And The basic story goes like this. He is deeply depressed about the demise of the Soviet Union. He considers this to be one of the great tragedies of all time. And what he's doing is he's trying to create a greater Russia. And that greater Russia is, in effect, going to look a lot like the former Soviet Union. His taking of Crimea and the fact that he's made it clear that he's bent on taking at least eastern Ukraine and more of and possibly all of Ukraine is evidence of that. And by the way, if we don't stop him in Ukraine, it won't be long before he gobbles up the Baltic states, and then we're really in trouble. So we're dealing here with a highly aggressive individual who has a state that has a significant amount of military capability, and he can use that military capability for offensive or aggressive purposes. And many people would argue that it was very good that we were expanding NATO before this crisis, because that just indicates, right, that this guy is aggressive, and it was smart to think in terms of trying to contain him. Some people go as far as to hint that he's the second coming of Adolf Hitler, or if not that, the second coming of Joseph Stalin. I think these arguments are wrong. The arguments that he's the second coming of Adolf Hitler are ludicrous in the extreme, right? Anybody who knows anything about Adolf Hitler in World War II knows that there's nothing in Putin's background or in anything he's done up to now that puts him in that category or even close to that category. This is not to say that Putin is a nice guy. This is not to say that Putin is not an autocrat. This is not to say that he's not a thug. This is simply to say that there's no evidence that he is bent on conquest. And the best evidence of that is that before February 22nd, that's when all the trouble started, February 22nd, 2014, you can find no evidence of American policymakers or European policymakers warning that he was about to go on a rampage and that we had to contain him. You can find no evidence that NATO expansion was designed to contain Russia. In fact, Michael McFaul, who was our ambassador to Russia in the second part of the Obama administration, has said publicly, right, that there is no reason to think that NATO was designed to contain Putin. And Mike McFaul says he told Putin on numerous occasions that NATO expansion was not designed to contain Russia. And that's, again, because we did not see Putin as bent on aggression. All of this is to say, up until February 22nd, no evidence that anybody thought he was highly aggressive. It's only after February 22nd when the crisis broke out. Furthermore, there's no way that Putin or Russia can turn present-day Russia into greater Russia by conquering huge swaths of territory. This is a country that is in serious trouble economically and politically and has little military might. It does have thousands of nuclear weapons, but nuclear weapons have almost zero offensive military capability. And the conventional forces of the conventional forces of Russia are not capable of swallowing up huge swaths of territory in Eastern Europe. Indeed, I say to people who are interested in undermining Putin that the best way to undermine Putin is to get him to invade Ukraine. You remember what happened when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan? You remember what happened when the Americans invaded Afghanistan? You remember what happened when the Americans invaded Iraq? You remember what happened when the Israelis went into southern Lebanon? Let's get Putin trying to conquer Ukraine. It will not work. It will be like trying to swallow a porcupine, especially given the limited military capability he has. So the idea that he's bent on creating a greater Russia and that he has the military capability to do that is simply not in the cards. Again, there's no evidence that he was bent on doing that. And number two, there's no evidence that he has the capability to do it. So this brings us to what's really going on here, the real reason that we have this crisis. The real reason is that the West and the United States has been in the driver's seat here, and the West Europeans have basically gone along with us, is that we are interested in peeling both Ukraine and Georgia away from Russia's orbit and making Ukraine and Georgia bulwarks of the West, right on Putin's doorstep. Now, there are three parts to the strategy. The first part is NATO expansion. The second part is EU expansion. And the third part is the effort to promote democracy in places like Ukraine and Georgia. And when you talk about promoting democracy, what you're really talking about is putting in power leaders who are pro-Western and anti-Russian. Okay, it's very important to understand that's what the Rose Revolution in Georgia was all about, and it's what the Orange Revolution in Ukraine was all about. Americans love these revolutions because they facilitate the promotion of liberal democracy, and I understand that, but you also want to understand that the liberal Democrats who were then going to be put in power were going to be pro-American. Right? So you're talking about a situation here where the way you make the way you make Ukraine and the way you make Georgia part of the West is to, one, incorporate them into NATO, two, incorporate them into the EU, and three, promote liberal democracy, which means putting into power leaders who are pro-Western. Okay. Now let's just talk a little bit about each one of those. First of all, with regard to NATO, when the Cold War ended, in informal discussions, the United States, and especially the Germans, made it clear to the Russians that there would be no NATO expansion. It was never put in writing, but we now have all the memos of the meetings. They've been all declassified, and they're in the public record now, of what the West said to Gorbachev about NATO expansion. And we said there would be no NATO expansion. However, after the Clinton administration came to power, they became intoxicated with the idea of expanding NATO eastward. And there were two tranches, one in 1999, the other in 2004, that ended up incorporating countries like Poland, Hungary, and even the Baltic states in that second tranche into NATO. The Russians screamed bloody murder the entire time. The Russians said that NATO expansion was unacceptable, but of course they were weak enough. You all remember how weak the Russians were under Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s. They couldn't do much about it. But then, in April 2008, we had the famous NATO summit at Bucharest, and at the end of that summit, NATO said that Ukraine and Georgia would eventually become part of NATO. The Russians put their foot down and said that this is categorically unacceptable. It is no accident, ladies and gentlemen, that in August 2008, remember the Bucharest summits in April 2008, in August 2008, you had a war between Georgia and Russia. It was over this very issue. The Russians made it clear in August that there was no way that Georgia was going to become part of NATO. There was no way that Georgia was going to become a Western bulwark on their doorstep. And of course, this contributed in important ways, and I'll talk more about that, to the crisis that we face today. Second part of the strategy was EU expansion, right? And the idea here was that what you would do is you would slowly but steadily incorporate Ukraine into the European Union. You would get it integrated economically into the West. And this, of course, would help facilitate making Ukraine part of the West's orbit, not Russia's orbit. And then again, the third part of the strategy, as I pointed out to you, was to promote democracy, which was all about putting in power pro-Western leaders. Right? So it's these three strategies which the Russians were spooked by. They were spooked by all three strategies that was the background cause of the crisis. Now, what we want to know is what actually happened to precipitate the crisis on February 22nd of 2014. I gave you the background cause, which was this strategy to peel Ukraine away from Russia's orbit. But what caused the crisis on February 22nd? It goes back to the fall of 2013. In the fall of 2013, right, this is roughly 4 months before the February 22nd coup, the president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, President Yanukovych, who was flirting with the EU to put together an economic deal that would pull Ukraine closer to the West, closer to the EU, decided to deep six the deal. He decided the deal was unacceptable, and instead he decided to cut a deal with Putin and the Russians. When this happened in late November of 2013, protests broke out in Ukraine against Yanukovych's decision. What Yanukovych did was very unpopular in the western part of Ukraine. And protests continued, and they got more troublesome for Yanukovych over time. And eventually, we ended up in a situation where people were even killed at some of the protests. Okay? So this is one of the precipitating causes. The second precipitating cause is that on February 22nd, you had a coup in Ukraine where Yanukovych was overthrown by pro-Western forces, aided by the United States. The United States was backing this coup. How much the United States was backing this coup, we don't know at this point in time. But there is evidence that we were backing the coup. We were funding the opposition to Yanukovych. This is all part of our interest in promoting democracy. And what happened was Yanukovych was overthrown. This is a democratically elected government under Yanukovych. He was overthrown, and he was replaced by a pro-Western leadership. Immediately thereafter, the Russians took Crimea. This happened in early March. And then, almost simultaneously, conflict broke out in the eastern part of Ukraine, where a large number of Russian speakers began to talk and act on the idea that they should become separate from Ukraine and maybe even integrate into Russia. And of course, that conflict in eastern Ukraine continues today, and Crimea, for all intents and purposes, is lost to Ukraine and has become part of Russia. So the story that I'm telling you here is that it was NATO's efforts, the EU's efforts, and the effort to promote democracy that created the background conditions for this crisis. And what actually precipitated it over the course of the late fall 2013 and early 2014 was the protests over the decision by Yanukovych to nix the deal with the EU, and then the coup, which was supported by the Americans. Now, what about the Russian response, right? Why did the Russians do this? The Russian response is highly understandable. The idea that the Russians did something that should be difficult to understand from a Western point of view is something I don't get at all. The Russians made it clear that from a geostrategic point of view, it was categorically unacceptable for NATO to drive the alliance right up to its doorstep. Why we didn't understand this, I don't get. Mike McFaul says that he kept telling the Russians, he kept telling Putin and Putin's lieutenants that this was not a threat to Russia. The Russians said, we don't believe that for 1 second. From our point of view, this is a threat. The idea that a military alliance that was our mortal enemy for 45 years can remain intact after the Cold War ends, and that that military alliance can be driven right up to our border and we don't worry about it, is not the way the world works. This is what they effectively said. But we kind of didn't get that. Think about the United States of America. As almost all of you know, we have something called the Monroe Doctrine. And that means that we do not like distant great powers coming into the Western Hemisphere. Almost everybody in this room is old enough to remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. I certainly am. You remember how we went ballistic at the thought that the Soviets were deploying military forces in the Western Hemisphere? This was simply unacceptable. It's one of the reasons that we've had Castro in our gun sight for decades. He had the audacity to invite the Soviets to bring military forces into the Western Hemisphere. And then after the Cuban Missile Crisis, he and the Russians were talking about establishing a naval base, a Russian naval base at Cienfuegos. We told the Russians in no uncertain terms, this is not happening. This is our hemisphere. You're not allowed in here. That's what the Monroe Doctrine is all about. But whether you like the Monroe Doctrine or not, that's the way great power politics works. Great powers are very sensitive about their security. They are very sensitive about their neighborhood. The idea that they're going to allow another great power to come in to their neighborhood and march right up to their border, it's not going to happen. And this is what the Russians said. This is what Putin said. And we refuse to believe this. So the Russian response is completely understandable. Let me give you another hypothetical situation. Let's assume in 30 years that China becomes really powerful, right? And it decides to form a military alliance with Canada and Mexico. And it talks about creating the situation where it might even move military forces into Canada and Mexico. You think the United States is going to sit by and say, we don't care? And then the Chinese ambassador is going to come over here to us. Chinese Ambassador Washington is going to come over and say, this is not threatening. You don't have anything to worry about. We're just forming a military alliance with Canada and Mexico. You don't think we're going to go ballistic? That's not going to happen, right? The United States is not going to tolerate China forming a military alliance with Canada or Mexico. In fact, the United States is not going to tolerate China forming a military alliance with anybody in the Western Hemisphere. Again, that's what the Monroe Doctrine is all about. So why should you expect Putin to tolerate NATO marching up to Russia's doorsteps? And the answer is, you shouldn't. And the fact is, he views this, as I said earlier, as an existential threat. That's what he views this as. This is an existential threat to him. You can't get through this through the heads of American policymakers and American elites. They just don't see it this way. But that's the way the Russians see it. And that's who counts. This is the argument I had with Michael McFaul when I debated him in London, right? As I said to him, I don't care what you think, because what you think doesn't matter. Whether you think NATO is a threat to Russia doesn't matter. It's what the Russians think. And when you start taking a great power and poking it in the eye with a stick, and that great power has nuclear weapons, you should be very careful, very careful. I know a lot of history. I know a lot about great power relations. And as I said to you before, great powers do very bad things when they get scared, as we have proved since September 11th. Right? So what's the Russian response? The Russian response is first to take Crimea. Crimea has strategic significance for the Russians. They had a naval base there. In fact, they really didn't have to invade Crimea. Oftentimes, you'll see in the newspaper evidence articles that say that the Russians invaded Crimea. They did not invade Crimea. They were already there. They had a lease to maintain a naval base at Sevastopol, and according to the lease, they were allowed to have 25,000 troops in Crimea. So they had large numbers of troops there. They didn't invade it. They just took it, right? That's the first thing they did. And then the second thing is they helped facilitate trouble in eastern Ukraine. Now, if you want to know what's going on in eastern Ukraine, Putin is not bent on conquering Ukraine. He's not a fool. He knows what happened to the Soviet Union when it invaded Afghanistan. He knows what happened to the Americans when they invaded Afghanistan. Right? So he's not invading. What he's doing is he's wrecking Ukraine. He's destroying Ukraine as a functioning society. And he's saying, we have two choices here, right? Either the West backs off and I'll leave Ukraine alone, or you continue to try to make Ukraine part of the West and I'll prevent that from happening by wrecking the country. That's what he's doing. He's wrecking the country. It's just very simple. And he, in effect, was pushing down the same road in Georgia, right, with Abkhazia and Ossetia, right? He's basically saying, you're not going to have a viable country that can then become part of the West. I'll just wreck it in the process. And, of course, if you look at what we are doing, we meaning the West, we are basically telling the Ukrainians, to continue to play hardball with the Russians. We are continuing to encourage the Ukrainians to think that they can become part of the West. And in a sense, therefore pushing them to pursue policies that are going to guarantee the destruction of their country. And at the same time, we're doing nothing to defend Ukraine. You understand, we have made it clear that Ukraine is not a core strategic interest to the United States. We are not committing troops to defend Ukraine. John McCain, who has never seen a war he didn't like until now, has finally reached a point where he's found a conflict he doesn't want us to fight in. You don't hear John McCain calling us to fight and defend Ukraine. We're not going to fight and defend Ukraine. The West, Europeans, are not going to fight and defend Ukraine. So what we're doing is pushing the Ukrainians to continue to irritate and anger the Russians and cause the Russians to do more and more to wreck their country while we're doing nothing to help the Ukrainians. We're leading them down the primrose path. This is highly irresponsible. And why the Ukrainians don't understand what's happening befuddles me. Right. But Putin is bent on making sure Ukraine does not become part of the West. And from his point of view, it makes perfect geostrategic sense. And the fact that we did not understand that, and the fact that the West Europeans did not understand that, is really quite remarkable. This brings me to my final point, or set of points. And that is the question of where we go from here. As I said to you in my introductory remarks, I think there's a very simple solution here. And why we haven't adopted this solution really puzzles me. The solution is take NATO expansion off the table, take EU expansion off the table, right? And go to great lengths to turn Ukraine into a neutral buffer state. In other words, go to great lengths to make it clear that it will not become a pro-Western state that it is in any meaningful way opposed to Russia. And make it clear that you're not going to push Ukraine into the arms of the Russians. You want a neutral buffer state, which is effectively what you had between 1992 and 2013. Nobody would have invited me up here between 1992 and 2013 to talk about the Ukraine crisis. There was no Ukraine crisis. Ukraine was basically a neutral buffer state. And when NATO expansion involved countries like Poland and Hungary and Romania and Bulgaria and countries like that, there was no really serious problem from the Russians. The real trouble began, as I said to you, in April 2008 with Ukraine and Georgia. That's when we went a bridge too far. The Russians made that very clear to us, right? So we had no real problem. And it wasn't until the fall of 2013 and early 2014 that this all blew up. Even in the summer of 2013, despite the fact that we were continuing to push NATO expansion, continuing to push EU expansion, we hadn't done enough to precipitate a crisis. What happened was you had these protests that then led to the coup on February 22nd, and the coup was the straw that broke the camel's back. Right? So there was no problem in the past. We ought to go back to the status quo ante. We had to go back to a situation where we work with the Russians to keep Ukraine neutral and to make it a buffer state between the Russians on one side and NATO on the other. And by the way, the Russians, and Putin in particular, have made it clear that this is what they want to do. Putin does not want to pick a fight with us. Putin has no interest in this present conflict. He's doing this so he can get a greater Russia? Come on. He's not going to conquer Ukraine. He'd be out of his mind. He doesn't need this. Look at what's happening to his economy. He may enjoy better standing in terms of public opinion these days, but over the long term, this is a disastrous situation for him. He has no interest in wrecking the Russian economy. He has no interest in getting into a big fight with the West. For what reason? This is why he helped Barack Obama out over Syria. This is why he's helped us out with Iran. He's scared of the Chinese. He'd be an ally of ours against the Chinese if we hadn't driven him into the arms of the Chinese. So, my bottom line here is twofold. One is, he did not create this crisis. We created this crisis. And number two, our present policy in the wake of the coup in February 22nd, 2014 has been foolish in the extreme. It's poisoned relations between the Russians and the Americans. It's made war more dangerous. And most importantly, it's done egregious damage to Ukraine, and it promises to do even greater damage in the future. Thank you.
First of all, thank you, Evanston Neighbors for Peace, for setting this up. It's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor to share the panel with Professor Mearsheimer. He, as many of you know, and if you don't, I'd recommend you read it, wrote a remarkable article in Foreign Affairs, the publication, or Foreign Affairs, yeah, the Council of Foreign Relations, in which he not only spoke truth to power, which is bold and valiant, he spoke truth within the corridors of power, which is rare and almost unprecedented, I think, to the degree that it, both the candor and the accuracy of that article, and I'll have frequent opportunity in the course of my presentation to remark about several aspects of it. One thing Professor Mearsheimer did correctly identify, the crisis in Ukraine right now is a war. It is a war. It, the Ukrainian press, English language press, as of this morning, reports, depending on which account you read, several soldiers killed, as many as 20 wounded within the preceding 24 hours. Today is day 270 of what the regime in Kiev refers to euphemistically as an anti-terrorist operation, 270 days of armed conflict in Europe. I had occasion earlier, about the time Dr. Mearsheimer was speaking about the change in government in February of last year in Kiev, to categorize the crisis, I think quite in keeping with what we all believe, is you know, the fifth act in a tragedy whose title is NATO expansion. And as was mentioned by Dr. Mearsheimer, in 1999, the first time in the post-Cold War era, the U.S., on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the foundation of its military bloc, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, held for the first time a summit in the United States in Washington, D.C., which marked simultaneously not only the jubilee anniversary of NATO and the fact that a NATO summit was held in the United States. Keep in mind, this is a military alliance that, in theory, was to protect Europe from Soviet expansion, but it's held now in Washington, D.C. in 1999, against the backdrop of the first post-Cold War expansion of that treaty organization, where Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary were brought in. Poland borders the Kaliningrad Oblast, which is part of Russian territory. So for the first time outside of Norway, we have a country that borders Russia brought into a U.S.-dominated military alliance. At the same time, NATO is conducting its first war, a 79-day air war against the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. In the interim, the so-called North Atlantic Treaty Organization has conducted wars in three continents. In Europe with Yugoslavia for 13 years in Afghanistan and Asia, and against Libya 4 years ago in Africa. At its latest summit in Wales in the United Kingdom last year, not only were there 28 members of NATO, the 28 members of NATO represented, and the expansion we're talking about, you know, from 1999 to 2009, 2009, Albania and Croatia were brought in, so that you had 12 nations joining NATO in a decade. That's a 75% increase in its membership in the Cold War period. It would have been 13, by the way, if except for the lingering name dispute between Greece and Macedonia. Macedonia would have been the third, incorporated in 2009. But at the Wales summit last year, in addition to representatives from the 28 full members of NATO, there are representatives from 49 partner countries. Do the arithmetic. At 77 countries, that's well over a third, closer to a half of the nations in the United Nations, members of the United Nations, belonging to a U.S.-led military bloc. There's, I think, one of the things we need to be very cautious about, and it was alluded to in the previous talk, is I believe that only government officials in the West, but certainly the mainstream media, are guilty of not only distorting, but inverting or reversing chronology and causality when they talk about the Ukrainian crisis. You know, for example, you know, it's a sort of self-exculpatory claim in the West, as Dr. Mearsheimer is alluding to. Good thing we expanded NATO, now we're prepared to deal with the crisis in the Ukraine. When in fact, you know, the Ukraine, one of the current Poroshenko government has announced they are scrapped, or the Verkhovna Rada, the parliament, is scrapping their erstwhile neutral status in terms of military bloc. Ukraine has never been neutral since the fragmentation of the Soviet Union. In February of 1994, Ukraine became the first former Soviet republic outside of the three Baltic states, which, you know, occupy a somewhat anomalous position, to join the so-called Partnership for Peace, which was a transitional program the Clinton administration and NATO elaborated in order to effect the expansion I talked about a second ago. That is to bring 12 new members into NATO, all of them in Eastern Europe, with the exception of Croatia and Slovenia, which were former federal republics of Yugoslavia, all of them former members of the Warsaw Pact, to the point where roughly a decade ago, then-President George W. Bush made an allusion to the fact, I'm probably quoting him almost word for word, that the Warsaw Pact is now NATO. And what that means is from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, the entire western flank of Russia, increasingly the southern flank of Russia, is being shored up by NATO expansion. In 2008, at the Bucharest summit, I should mention, by the way, earlier that year, because it was a U.S. presidential election, that Georgian websites, this was the period of the Mikhail Saakashvili government in Tbilisi, reproduce letters from, at that time, senators, but also presidential candidates, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, John McCain, which are almost identical in phraseology. It was evident they came from a common source. They all ended with exactly a comment that I noticed Dr. Mearsheimer used in his article in Foreign Affairs, the catchphrase, Europe whole and free. And I think it's very important to realize the genesis of that expression, an alternate version of which is Europe whole, free, and at peace. That is an Orwellian inversion of the truth, I can assure you, the addition of the third term. In 1989, President George, the first George Bush, made a statement in Mainz, Germany, and this is, I believe, immediately before the collapse of the Berlin Wall and perhaps a year before German reunification, and the speech had that title, Europe whole and free. And it was clear that policymakers in the United States, but also their NATO allies in Europe, were envisioning some sort of continental system in Europe. And that continental system, let's be real clear about this, there is not a single nation, European nation, including the island nations, with the exception of the micro-states like Andorra, Liechtenstein, Vatican, Monaco, that has not either been a full member of NATO or a member of the Partnership for Peace program, and in many instances, several intermediate programs. There's one called the Membership Action Program is the penultimate one for entering NATO, and several countries, particularly in the Balkans right now, have that status. Russia pulled out of the Partnership for Peace program in 1999 when the war against Yugoslavia was underway. Malta, the small island nation in the Mediterranean, temporarily pulled out because of a change in government, was reabsorbed, and the only nation that is standing out in all of Europe is the tiny island nation of Cyprus, which is now headed towards a Partnership for Peace. So what we're talking about is the entirety of Europe being subordinated to a military bloc controlled from the other side of the Atlantic, and nothing less. In his article, Professor Mearsheimer talked about the Eastern Partnership Program, which is vital to understand because this is the real precipitant for the crisis in Ukraine, the immediate precipitant. In 2008, Sweden and Poland, and we're talking about foreign minister at that time in Sweden, Carl Bildt, foreign minister at that time of Poland, Radoslaw Sikorski, who had lived in the United States, is married to an American journalist, worked for the Heritage Foundation, and so forth, crafted the Eastern Partnership, which was meant transparently to wean from the Commonwealth of Independent States, that is the essentially economic bloc that was thrown as a sop to Russia after the fragmentation of the Soviet Union, was meant, and it targeted all the former Soviet federal republics, excepting the Baltic states, which by that time had already joined both NATO and the European Union, and Russia itself, excluding the five Central Asian former Soviet republics for whom the EU has a comparable or an analogous program. But these countries that are targeted by the Eastern Partnership are Belarus, Armenia, Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, Azerbaijan, those six. All at that time, all formerly were members of the Commonwealth of Independent States. Georgia withdrew from that bloc after the August 2008 war with Russia. But what the European Partnership effectively would do is to destroy any autonomous post-Soviet organizations within former Soviet space. It would supplant for the Commonwealth of Independent States the European Union. It was in November of 2013 when the Yanukovych government, I don't know that they so much scrapped what was called an association agreement with the European Union under the auspices of the Eastern Partnership, as they simply postponed formalizing that relationship, which was rectified in due order after the coup in Kiev, you can be assured. And then what happened was a series of protests, which resulted not only in the deaths of protesters, let's recollect, but in the deaths of 12 to 16 police officers who were killed. One can only imagine how a situation of that sort would have be handled had it occurred in Washington, D.C. rather than Kiev in the Ukraine. When I mentioned that Ukraine has never been fully neutral, let me explain what that is. Though anything short of evidently 100% loyalty is not to be tolerated. The Kuchma government, Leonid Kuchma government, that is three governments removed right now, supplied almost 1,700 troops to the George W. Bush administration for the occupation of Iraq after the invasion in 2003 under what was called Multinational Forces Iraq, which was assisted by NATO. This was a goodwill gesture or a token of commitment, if you will, for NATO integration. Subsequently, this very same government we now derogate and condemn, the Yanukovych government, became the first non-NATO power to supply a naval vessel for NATO's now permanent interdiction and surveillance operation in the Mediterranean Sea, Operation Active Endeavor. It then followed that up by being the first non-NATO country to supply a ship for NATO's permanent naval operation in the off the Horn of Africa in the Arabian Sea, Operation Desert Shield. Up until the change in the regime 11 months ago in Ukraine, Ukraine was to have been one of four non-NATO countries to supply military personnel and equipment for NATO's response force, that is, its international strike force, in essence. The others were, revealingly, Georgia, Finland, and Sweden. So we see that, far from Yanukovych, the Yanukovych government in any way being hostile to NATO, he seemed, in my estimate, to be completely and unjustifiably accommodating to NATO. During the course even of the Yanukovych government, the yearly summer breeze NATO war games in the Crimean Peninsula continued to occur. The annual rapid Trident military exercises in the west of the country, NATO exercises, continued to occur. What we have in Ukraine right now is that there's a special irony in presenting the Russian government as being aggressive in this context or being overly protective. Let's use a term that's been used for several decades in reference to Russian foreign policy, paranoid. Along the lines of what Professor Mearsheimer was talking about, were one to if turnabout is fair play, and if every nation of the Western Hemisphere was brought into a Russian-dominated military bloc, I don't believe we would be paranoid in suspecting we were the likely target of that military expansion. And that's the same thing with Russia. But the association agreement of the Eastern Partnership with Ukraine, the rejection of which triggered the now 270-day war in that country, contains a very strong military component. And it would effectively intensify the integration of Ukraine into Western military structures. We have to recall that in the 1990s, in addition to the Partnership for Peace, launched in 1994, there was also a NATO program called Mediterranean Dialogue, which takes in seven countries in North Africa and in the Middle East. There's, as of the summit in Chicago, the NATO summit in Chicago 2012, a NATO partnership, which I think has the most revealing title, Partners Across the Globe. In Afghanistan for 13 years under the structure of the International Security Assistance Force, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization managed to integrate military forces from 50 nations and every inhabited continent. This is unparalleled in history, as is any military bloc containing, you know, 77 members and partners and so forth. This is what we have to see as the backdrop against which, you know, the crisis in Ukraine is occurring. We also have to know that as early as 2006, during the then George W. Bush administration, that successive heads of the Missile Defense Agency of the United States paid visits, initially surreptitiously, afterwards publicly, met with officials of the Viktor Yushchenko government and talked about incorporating Ukraine into the U.S.'s European and ultimately global missile defense system. That there was talk about either interceptor missiles being stationed in Ukraine or missile radar facilities being stationed there. I assume that's probably back on the drawing board right now. The other countries mentioned, by the way, you know, in 2006, 2008, were Georgia and Turkey. Turkey now has a long-range missile radar facility placed there as of 2 years ago. And the I want to say one last word, though, on the question of the 2008 Bucharest summit, because I forgot to follow up on it. At the time, as Professor Mearsheim was talking about, Georgia and Ukraine were promised full NATO partnership once they met the basic preconditions for that. And what the two major preconditions are: no territorial disputes or unresolved armed conflicts on the soil of the nation, you know, a candidate member, aspirant member. Number two, no foreign military personnel stationed on their territory, by which I think we could safely assume no non-NATO military personnel. Because when Cyprus joins the Partnership for Peace program, as it's going to do shortly, the fact that there are Turkish military personnel in the north of the country will in no way impede you know, Cyprus being brought into a NATO partnership program. So we had the cases, was alluded to earlier, that Georgia had two unresolved territorial disputes in Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Ukraine did not technically have one of what are referred to as frozen conflicts, but I think Crimea in many ways arguably was the fifth frozen conflict, because it did contain the Black Sea Fleet, you know, which Russia had, in, you know, going back decades before the Soviet Union, so this is not a Soviet phenomenon. And the, I would suspect that in the military, if not the political establishment in Moscow, there was a suspicion that after the the change of power in February of last year, that it was a matter of time before their Black Sea Fleet received an eviction notice. And I think that may very well be one of the reasons that Russia struck first, to the extent it did at all. So a couple of things I think we have to keep in mind here is that, and let me just, because I know I've heard from people, I was on a Russian debate with Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution, who accused me of gross and unconscionable exaggeration in terms of NATO buildup in Eastern Europe since the crisis in Ukraine ensued. And he was talking about, you know, minor, you know, military drills and so forth. In March of last year, in last year's iteration of a NATO exercise called Cold Response, it was held in the Arctic Circle, roughly 200 miles from Russian territory. It included over 16,000 troops from 16 nations, including Sweden and Finland. And again, you know, along the lines of the you know, the allegory that Dr. Mearsheimer mentioned, not to worry, right? I mean, there's no reason for Russia to be concerned about 16,000 troops in major war games a couple of hundred miles from their border. I believe it's incumbent on us, first of all, to realize that I'm afraid at this point, intractable. I would like to believe the formula that was offered earlier, wise as it is, you know, will be acted upon, and we can retreat from what is, you know, potentially a very dangerous confrontation. I should let you know that both of us panelists objected to the original title that was proposed for this talk, which included words to the effect of, you know, nuclear war or something. However, I woke up this morning to see somebody not noted for ever having been, you know, tremendously confrontational with the West, former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev, talk about just that prospect. I don't know if anyone saw that today. where you talked about the crisis potentially, you know, which had the potential to spin out of control and eventually lead to a nuclear war. So I don't believe that's a distinct prospect, but we shouldn't even discuss the percentages on that one. This is something that is fraught with that potential. It's dangerous beyond all comprehension. We need to step back. We need rationality. I'll go a step further, though, in my proposal. We not only need to call for immediate halt to NATO expansion, we need to call for the abolition of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which I consider the biggest threat to world peace.